You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Tonight, Antonio Damasio and Manuel Castells will discuss Antonio Damasio's new book, The Strange Order of Things, Life, Feeling, and the Making of Cultures, in which the preeminent neuroscientist continues his quest for a theory of human consciousness. And we're very honored, especially because today is the United States publication day of this book. It's already been published in Europe, but today is the day it's available to an American audience. You'll be hearing tonight probably about the biological roots of culture, particularly the role homeostasis plays in generating behavioral strategy. You will perhaps hear about bacteria with moral attitude. I really loved that part. The noted anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss suggested that it was probably necessary for the history of mankind that the world of the senses, as well as the world of mythical thought, be denied, for it enabled scientific thought to constitute itself, an interesting theory. Descartes' assertion in the 17th century that our bodies were merely machines, for example, won scientists the right to perform autopsies, previously prohibited by the church. In one of his earlier books, Descartes' Error, Antonio Damasio called into question the old distinctions between reasoning and feeling, mind and body, confirming with his own observations with brain damaged patients that the Cartesian thought experiment of a disembodied mind is a contradiction in terms. The mind only exists in conjunction with the body. And in his book, Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain, Damasio explored another precedent for his vision of the mind-body connection, the Dutch philosopher Baruch Spinoza, who anticipated much of what neuroscientists are now learning about the human brain, in particular about the biological underpinnings of feelings and even consciousness itself. Damasio considers Spinoza, who was excommunicated for his efforts, a proto-biological thinker, and Spinoza, as Damasio is too, are thinkers unafraid of crossing disciplinary boundaries. Both our guests tonight are highly celebrated for their career achievements, and I'm only going to mention brief bios because otherwise we will never get to our conversation. Antonio Damasio is David Dornsife Professor of Neuroscience, Neurology, and Psychology, and Director of the Brain and Creativity Institute at USC. He's the recipient of many awards, including the Asturias Prize in Science and Technology. And among his books I haven't mentioned earlier, he is the author of The Feeling of What Happens and Self Comes to Mind. A prolific scholar, the author of over 30 books, Manuel Castells, our interlocutor tonight, is Wallace Annenberg Chair of Communication, Technology, and Society at USC. His trilogy includes, among his books, The Information Age, Economy, Society, and Culture, which is translated into 22 languages. In a recent review in The Guardian of Antonio Damasio's new book, the novelist John Banville called The Strange Order of Things, quote, an intricately argued book, which is at once scientifically rigorous and humanely accommodating, and as far as this reviewer can judge, revolutionary. And he ended his review with a beautiful tribute. Damasio, he said, while ever ready to salute his predecessors and peers, is wholly his own man, and the strange order of things is a fresh and daring effort to identify the true spring and source of human being, of the being, in fact, of all living things, namely feeling. Please join me in welcoming Antonio Damasio and Manuel Castells.
So, good evening. Let me start by saying that Antonio Damasio's book, The Strange Order of Things, is, as I have written publicly, likely to trigger a new scientific revolution, not less than that. And the reason is that it's a systematic, rigorous analysis based on science, on the interplay between biology and culture in the production of the human condition, respecting the autonomy of both processes and analyzing their interplay, which is contrary to what many scientists have been trying to do, deriving everything from biology, or many cultural analysts or sociologists trying to derive everything is cultural, everything is social. Well, no, it's biological and cultural. But the trick is how. And that's what Antonio Damasio has explained in this book, which is indispensable from now on. And in fact, the review of The Guardian that you had been mentioned, and also, more importantly, even the leading science journal, Nature, has just published a review along the same terms, and Le Monde, and so on and so on. So it's not just my opinion. We converge with many interesting, serious, and I would say impartial observers of what this book is. So let's start with some substantive discussion, because this is not only about praising the book, it's about understanding the book, and the understanding through his through the analysis of the author of the book, which is the only way to understand it. So first of all, Antonio, what do you mean when in page 19 of your book, it's an innocent question, it's just it's referred. You say that, no, it's very easy. This is not the aggressive question, they come later. That bacteria do not engage in phenomenology. Because in fact, you have a great sympathy for bacteria. That because at the same time, you respect their survival intelligence, and they have no brain. So please explain your love for bacteria.
Right. So that's, first of all, thank you very much, Manuel. That's very friendly of yours, and that's... in spite of it, you're correct, let's say. It's a very important question, because the idea of phenomenology is, you know, we have this capacity, all of us in this room, to look into our own mind. It's in fact one of the most interesting aspects of our process of consciousness, is that it's not just to be alive and to look at the world outside, it's to have the possibility, the sense, that we are looking at ourselves doing the looking. So there's always, in the process of consciousness, there are these two presences. There's the presence of a me that is doing the looking or the hearing or the touching and the feeling, and there's the something else that is the real me that is doing the watching, the hearing, the sensing. And that's, in fact, the heart of the process of phenomenology. And the term is a classical term. It comes from philosophy, and it implies that we are doing an observation not only on what's outside of us, but we're doing an observation on our own inside, doing the observation. Now, this is obviously something that we can do, and I think many other living creatures do. We cannot obviously make great claims about what a dog or an elephant or a sea mammal will be able to do. I suspect that they actually have something that is very close. But it's perfectly obvious that bacteria, which are incredibly complex, cannot do that. And the reason why it's very unlikely that they can do that is because really they don't have a brain. They have a complicated body that is run by chemical molecules and is extremely intelligent in its behavior. They have something that we could call self-interest, even if they don't have a self. In other words, their whole organism is oriented towards protecting itself and continuing and flourishing in life, defending itself against, for example, famine, and against other enemies, but there's no indication that they have the power to look out into the world in the way we do. What is the way in which we look out into the world? Just think a little bit. Right now, you are seeing me and hearing me, looking at Manuel as well. So you have the ability to have representations of the world that are configurational. There's something in your mind, through the help of your nervous system, that allows you to pick up on a lot of the configurations that are out in the world and, as far as we can tell, resemble what's out in the world. And in order to do that, you had to have a complicated nervous system. Probably you had to wait until about 500 to 600 million years ago. But when you're talking about bacteria, we're talking about 4 billion years ago. So there's a huge transcourse of time in the history of life on Earth during which there were no nervous systems and there was therefore no possibility of creating these complicated representations. And that's why I say I'm glad you seized on that, because I thought I was having great fun by saying bacteria don't engage in phenomenology, and that's the answer. They don't have that. What is very interesting is to think about all the things that they do have. For example, they can recognize other bacteria because of the molecules that each bacteria exhibits in the membrane. So there are proteins that are expressed in the membrane that allow one bacterium to sense that the other is, for example, a next of kin, or that another one is a stranger. But that is done chemically. It's in fact something that would be closer to what eventually became in us the sense of smell and the sense of taste, which are a much simpler, not that they're unimportant, they're very important senses, but they're simpler than this incredibly rich sense of touch that we have, in which I can appreciate the shape of this chair or this book, the qualities of the texture. I can hear what you say. I hear the particular kind of sound that this room has, and I can see configurations in all of you. This is, you really have to wait a long time to get this possibility. And there's one word that is key to this, is mapping. You need to have the possibility of making maps, whether it is a map of what you touch, or a map of what you hear, or a map of what you see. Bacteria cannot get there, as far as I can say, but they can do lots of other things.
Well, listening to you, I was thinking an organism with survival intelligence and no brain, maybe our president is a megabacteria. Well, but after this relax, let's go into the central concept of your work, which is homeostasis. And I led you the work of defining it, to be short. But ultimately, it's related to the trend to reach a steady state by both individuals and systems in the biological world. The problem when we try to find, and I'm not saying you do it, but many people then try to immediately shift from that homeostasis search in the biological world to the social and cultural world. And that's completely different, because in my analysis, in a long social science tradition, all societies are based on power relationships, because those in power set up the norms and the institutions by which we are governed. And therefore, any change has to be enacted by social movements or other actors in conflict with the dominant values, which therefore the natural state of societies and cultures is conflictive, not homeostatic in that sense. Now, you're so aware of all this that you multiply your references to processes within the homeostatic state, which also try to innovate, because if it doesn't innovate, it doesn't change, and it doesn't change, anything that doesn't change dies. Yep. And certainly it's clear in societies, but also clear in biology. So, my direct question, because this is central in your work, how you define homeostasis and how you establish the balance between the search for stability and the process of change that ultimately tends to challenge the existing rules to improve it.
Yeah. So that's a long and complex question. Let's divide it in parts. First, a definition of homeostasis. First, a confession. Homeostasis is a word that I don't like. And it's a word that I don't like because it suggests the opposite of what it really does. It suggests stasis. It suggests calm, balance, equilibrium, all the things that life is not really about. But it is, there's something there that is very well captured, this homeostasis. It's the idea, and it's a word with a very complicated history. It's the idea that life, in order to be maintained, needs to have some kind of balance, needs to have what is best called, in chemical terms, a steady state, one of many steady states that is compatible with survival. And if it is outside of one of those steady states, the whole thing falls apart. And you really get into disorder. There's one person that dealt with this problem very much, and that is a physicist by the name of Schrödinger, who was a great genius of physics and a laureate physicist, but then in 1944 wrote a book called What is Life? And he ventured into this new field, but he actually produced a lot of very interesting observations. And he said, all systems tend towards disorder, and there's this thing that happens to living organisms, which is a way of preserving the order, of resisting the tendency to go into disorder. Mm-hmm. So homeostasis is that. Is this thing that is part of our living systems, and which is obviously a physico-chemical process that resists disorder, and the chemical reactions that are happening inside a cell or inside a whole organism as a whole are modes of resisting that and adopting a certain steady state. What is so interesting is that chemically you can have several possible steady states. And there's some in which you barely, it's like having your household, and at the end of the month you're having gotten exactly the same expenses as your income. Or if you're a little luckier, you're having at the end of the month, you have a little bit more income than you were able to spend. Okay? So when that happens, you are in the best of all possible worlds as far as life is concerned. In other words, you spend the energy that you've just procured and fabricated, and you have a reserve of energy that in fact allows you to go into the future. It's a pity that the word homeostasis suggests stasis, when in fact there's no stasis because there's this dynamic process. There have been attempts at using other words like allostasis, for example. And there's one that I actually like, and I talk about it in the book very briefly, and that's homeodynamics. And it's a word that I attribute in the book to two people that actually wrote extensively about it. And it's interesting because I got a letter this morning from a very famous British biologist by the name of Stephen Rose, and he said, well, you didn't really give me credit for the word homeodynamics. I gave credit to the word homeodynamics to another person, and because they did write about it. But I was there first. He said, okay. Homeodynamics is actually a better word. But in the end, when you use those alternate and better words, what happens is that people don't adopt them. You know, I have been trying to explain to people for at least 20 years that emotions and feelings are different things, that emotions are movements and feelings are experiences, and people still confuse emotions and feelings. It's obvious that they're going to continue doing so. So I decided that I was not going to fight the battle of homeostasis. Let it be homeostasis if you want, and if people want to protest, that's fine. Now, the second part of Manuel's question is really very important. In what way can you transfer these notions of procuring a steady state, procuring a way of maintaining a surplus of energy so that you have not only energy for the rainy day, but for the future in general, you know, this idea of surplus, which is the thing that, you know, when you have the sense that you're happy and that you are flourishing, that's exactly what flourishing is telling you. It's telling you that your organism is not only running pretty well and that you're not sick, but your organism actually has energy that is sufficient to go on for the next hours and the next days. It's this projection into the future that poetically you can capture by the sense of flourishing. Okay, in what way do societies do something like this? Well, I think that the way societies ended up being organized was as a projection of this quote-unquote desire on the part of living creatures. And especially when the societies were not just of bacteria or of insects, but actually of people with consciousness and with the sense of what they felt, there was the desire to procure that. The fact that that's the desire doesn't mean that that's how it works. And in fact, when you look at history, even with the nicest rose-colored glasses, what you see is that you have moments of success in which there are relative balances, but you have moments of failure. And wars are exactly an expression of what you just said. And it's part of your tradition, looking at cultures as dominated by powers. And of course, when you have the clash of powers, you're going to have to go to war because there's no other solution unless you can negotiate and resolve the clash of powers. But powers themselves are, curiously enough, an expression of homeostasis in the sense that they are an expression of feelings. Isn't it true that if you have a power that is fighting another power, you have that power because you have a feeling force that pushes you into the attack, that allows you to be emotionally stronger and angry, for example, or even violent in relation to another. So I think that your analysis in terms of powers is perfectly compatible with the fact that not only is there a homeostatic desire, but a homeostatic desire that is expressed through emotions and therefore ends up in feelings. Would you accept that?
Well, I would accept that it's a possibility, but I would not say powers and powers. I would say power and counterpower, meaning that there are power relationships that are challenged when enough people do not feel represented by the institutions on which these power relationships are founded. Right. So it's not symmetrical.
Right.
Not symmetrical.
Right.
And therefore, the whole history is a conflict that produces new institutions that then later on are challenged. So the natural state of societies is conflict, right. Not homeostasis.
In other words, absolutely. But you know, the natural state of societies of bacteria is also not without complicated power relationships. In fact, there are beautiful experiments where you have different strains of bacteria with different amounts of nutrients, and they are power relationships in a way, quote-unquote, the same way that the moral attitudes are also quote-unquote. They're attitudes that a group can represent. But I think maybe one way in which we can find agreement is by saying that there is a desire to that homeostasis socially, the concept of sociocultural homeostasis, for example, it's something that you struggle to get. And in fact, you can sort of try to, in the best of possible worlds, you want a group to be in sociocultural homeostasis up to a point, provided that sociocultural homeostasis benefits from this feature that is essential to the definition of homeostasis, which is to have the surplus to go on, in other words, to have energy to innovate, to create, to modify the status quo.
Well, in fact, this is the tension that is in your book between what, on the one hand, you clearly are part of the tradition of the Enlightenment, in which the notion of human progress, we have higher life expectancy, more educated people than ever, some sort of democracy of sorts, and many things, extraordinary progress in medicine, etc. But in your book, yourself, at the same time, because you are so conscious of all the aspects, you say yes, but in fact, many of these progress are canceled with impulses of destruction. Even in page 174, you say cultural creativity may lead, and lead in fact, to destruction. For instance, to design new and more powerful weapons that trigger wars of extermination.
Right.
And then you mentioned the whole thing, climate change, increasing inequality. So you are taken between a classical tradition in science that, because we had greater scientific knowledge and technological power, we actually have evolved as a super species. And then you look around and say, but this is a total catastrophe. And the species may disappear because of the stupidity and the inability to manage life.
Absolutely.
Which the two poles, and that, for me, is one of the most beautiful and important tensions and analysis in your book.
Well, thank you. And I think it's a fact that you cannot ever, when you look at the way life is today, and I'm not thinking about a particular country, I'm thinking about obviously the world that we know of through media or through visiting a particular place. There's this same tension. There are really things that have been marvelous in terms of the development, especially technical development, scientific development, and even development of the understanding of people at certain levels. And at the same time, we're seeing catastrophic developments that have to do with, for example, the manipulation of media and with the appearance of new weapons and the clear ability to use those weapons, for example, the ones that people least talk about, which have to do with cyber warfare. So I don't think we can look at things through Pollyanna glasses. I think things are pretty complicated. And on the issue of the Enlightenment, it's quite interesting because historically, all the enlightened periods were followed by catastrophes. And there's no question when Germany and Austria had the most sophisticated cultures by the 19th century, it's difficult to imagine a place with more sophisticated music, poetry, painting, architecture than you can find, for example, in Vienna. And then, very quickly on the heels of that, you have Nazism. And you have also, as a great, highly motivated by Enlightenment ideas, you have the development of communism in the Soviet Union, which is one of the greatest catastrophes ever, if not the greatest catastrophe, and develops throughout the 20th century. So and that, I think, comes from the over-acceptance of the power of reason. This idea that we know things, and if you know things, you can reason through things, and you can, because we're enlightened, we can impose it to everybody around. And if they don't follow you, it's because they're tribal. That's too simple a story. You know, we are, everything that we do culturally needs to be negotiated. Guess what? By feelings. You're not going to be able to impose work. There's actually work at the Brain Creativity Institute. There's a very recent paper by Jonas Kaplan, one of our colleagues, where he demonstrates that it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to convince people of other political views. So if you can try to sort of hammer you're a conservative, and I'm going to say you have to become a liberal thinker, an enlightened thinker. And people resist. They do exactly the opposite. They don't want to be convinced. They don't want to be lectured and hammered. They don't want to have their beliefs, for example, take religious beliefs, imposed on. They want to adopt it through themselves. And it's a process of persuasion that is, in fact, an emotional and feeling negotiation.
Well, but to illustrate this tension between extraordinary technological development and the applications of these technologies, let's talk one second about what everybody is talking these days, artificial intelligence. You may know that the stock market crashed yesterday, after all the economists have exhausted the explanations in terms of salaries, prices, no, the machines did it. Because they were programmed to react to certain market tendencies, and then, because everybody more or less has the same algorithm, then the machines did it at the same time. So they pushed down the market. In fact, it happened already in October 1987, and a number of controls were established, but this time the machines are much more powerful and jump over the controls. At the same time, today, the machines went fast into rectifying what they had done. And some analysts have said, well, you see, this is the advantage of the machines, because they don't have emotions. That's the point. They don't have emotions. They don't panic. They just undo what they did. However, what they did yesterday ruined millions of people at one point, and many of the global marketers have still not recovered. So my point is, some people are saying the great thing about artificial intelligence is that the machines don't have emotions. They say emotions, by the way. It's interesting. So the question, your answer is obvious. No, of course, the machines don't feel, don't have emotions, etc. But I want you to elaborate on that, because some people, the most sophisticated of the artificial intelligence scientists, saying, wait a second. The machines have learning capacities. That's what artificial intelligence is about now. They can learn and develop their own system of decision making. So can we imagine a cyber world in which humans, we are dominated by feelings and emotions, as you have demonstrated scientifically, and machines are strictly rational and calculating? Who wins in that world? We are all over the place, not knowing exactly what we feel, and the machine just have a goal, and they apply methodically and scientifically. We are lost.
Yeah.
So what do you think about artificial intelligence nowadays, in general?
I think, of course, one has to be very careful not giving the impression that one is against artificial intelligence. I'm not against artificial intelligence at all. However, there is one chapter in the book, chapter 11, where I discuss many issues that have to do with us and artificial intelligence. The big problem that we have is the following. There is a misconception of what our intelligence is and what the intelligence of machines is. Now, the intelligence of machines, as Manuel just mentioned, the capacity to learn, the capacity to memorize and keep large banks of knowledge is huge, but it's not just huge, it's much bigger than ours. There's no way that we will ever have the amount of knowledge stored that you have in the world of computation today, with a cloud, for example, where you can have access to everything you want very fast. The ability to reason over that field of knowledge is huge as well and growing all the time. And that's the reason why we have these incredible successes at things like chess or Go, which are the result of having a tremendous amount of knowledge, easy, accessible, and manipulable, and having also a reasoning paradigms that are changing all the time, and even have the capacity to evolve. That's wonderful. But that corresponds to what in humans is a collection of processes that requires a lot of precision, and that includes perception, includes movement, includes the making of memories and the manipulation of memories, and the expression of all of that in the creative world and the expression in other languages. For example, the language that I'm using right now. All of this, the fact that I can learn, the fact that I can perceive, the fact that I can express myself in language in a very complex way requires a lot of precision and lends itself very easily to a computational account. This is the kind of thing that computers can do very well, and therefore they're going to get in this realm that I'm talking about. This is the kind of thing that brains, because in part of brains operate in this computational way can lend themselves to, you know, to imitating, in a way, simulating what the human mind can be at this level. Mm-hmm. What is lacking in those systems is the other great part that of our minds and of ourselves, that in fact is the foundation of our beings. And that is what has to do with the government of our bodies, the government of our metabolism, the way you run life, that is expressed in the form of feelings. And curiously, the first part is expressed in synaptic arrangements. So we know that the brain requires synaptic contacts from neuron to neuron and can operate in a way that lends itself to a computational description. What is going on in the world of our feelings is another story. And it is, in fact, clear that a great part of it operates in a non-synaptic way, and that the signaling that is done between neurons is not made at the level of synapses only, but is actually made probably in the majority of the cases in non-synaptic spaces, the extracellular space, around neurons, for example, in the brain and in peripheral parts of the nervous system. And it's made in a space that has direct access on the part of the rest of the body that is not neural. In other words, just imagine this. You have a compartment that is in our brain and that is largely in our cerebral cortex that operates synaptically, computational-like. And that gives us all these beauties, you know, perception, fine movement, language, and so forth, fine reasoning. And then you have this other stuff that is giving us what? Gives us our moods, gives us our sense of sadness or happiness, gives us our energy, our excitement, regulates our sleep and wake cycles. All of that part is, you know, you can construct mathematics to describe it, but it does not lend itself easily to the classical computer descriptions. And that is the part when people say, oh, we're going to have computers and we're going to have robots that mimic human beings. Well, not so fast. They're not going to mimic this foundational part of our beings, which is the thing that allows us to recognize ourselves as human beings. You know, we recognize ourselves because we can identify in others the kind of sentiments that we have. If we were reduced to all this very nice streamlined mathematics and language and fine perception and movement, we would be looking at each other as robots could look at each other. So there has to be a clarification about this. Interestingly, is a point where the definition of emotion is very important. Can robots have emotions? You bet they can. In fact, you can make a robot move the face in such a way that the robot can look at you and smile or frown or do all of those things. Because emotions are movement programs, they're actions. And you can mimic all of that. You know, Hannah and I have now been introduced to several robots in our travels in Japan or in Europe. And it's very interesting. I think I say in the book, I've never met a robot that I didn't like, and I've never met a robot that I didn't think liked me. Because, you know, they even program, when you go for a visit to a great laboratory, they will program you with your name, and so the robot will come to you and say, "Hello, Antonio," or "Hello, Hannah."
That's because they are Japanese.
Yes, that's true. That's because they're very polite. But they can do that in France, too, nowadays. So the fact is that you can program these things. Now, is the robot feeling anything? Of course not. The robot has been made to say those things, and there's no experience of happiness or unhappiness at meeting me.
You see, Antonio, confronted with the contradiction between extraordinary human creativity and the consequences of this creativity for the humans, you try in your book at one point, which is the less scientific but more moving part of the book, trying to find some way out. And you ultimately go back to the ideology of the Enlightenment. The solution is through education. Problem is, who educates the educators? Because although in political terms, education, the education institutions are among the most liberal institutions, in terms of culture, in terms of ability to understand and enact changes in attitudes, in transformation of life, is one of the most conservative institutions in the entire society. So which kind of education are you talking about?
Right. So I think that I was obviously waxing poetic and trying to find a way in arguing with myself about whether we should be happy and hopeful or very desperate. I was trying to convince myself that we cannot be desperate until we try a sort of Marshall Plan, GI Bill, massive educational program that I conceive in very open ways, with a mixture of science and a mixture of very rich humanities. But you're right. In the end, that is, it's an Enlightenment ideal. I think I would want to have it more open, more flexible, and certainly not imperative. And I was thinking about it mostly for the beginning of life. I was not thinking about a massive program for adults. I was thinking about what if we would have large or all aspects of societies open to and benefiting from a tremendous amount of knowledge, a tremendous amount of respect for other human beings, which, by the way, is one of the critical issues with feeling. You cannot expect robots to respect either living creatures or other robots if they don't have a feeling of what it is to lose your dignity or to be suffering. It's that critical issue that even people in the Enlightenment did not get, because they were so preoccupied with pushing away emotion and feeling and being reasonable and rational and knowledge and science-based, that they pushed away feeling. That's why they, for example, attacked religion, you know, non-stop, because it was too touchy-feely. And anyway, so the idea was to have something that would be more open and would respect feelings and would honor feelings, but at the same time honor this huge bank of knowledge that we now have from science of every kind, from biology and physics and chemistry, and honor as well the tradition of great literature and poetry and music and so forth. So if we had that, would there be a hope of salvation? Well, if you're someone like John Gray, you would say, forget it. You know, you're never going to get that. You know, this is going to come back again and again. But I still think that it would be, it's the only thing worth trying. If we don't do that, what else? So,
well, I will finish this part of the conversation, because the next stage is you, directly with Professor Damasio, by saying that the debate, philosophical, ethical, between, in terms of the nature, the human nature, the goodness or badness of the human nature, for centuries has been dominated by the opposition between Hobbes and humans as violent, and Rousseau as humans as able to engage in social contract and education and regenerate themselves. I would say the historical evidence supports Hobbes. The hope supports Rousseau. And now we have a third alternative, hopeful science through Damasio. Thank you for your interest.
Thank you.
Now it's up to you. I finished my work.
So there's been a lot of conversation about the singularity, Ray Kurzweil's thinking and some of that writing, and about self-aware computers. It sounds like from what you're saying, I hope I'm interpreting it correctly, that because they don't have to maintain themselves, they don't have that challenge of finding homeodynamics or homeostasis, that you don't believe robots can get to a singularity at any point. So could you speak about that?
So basically, I think you're saying something that is compatible with what I said. So it's in order for you to be conscious in the proper sense of the term, you need to have what we call subjectivity. You need to have a sense of you as a subject. We go back to the beginning of the evening in which I was talking about this sense that there's someone inside me that is doing the watching and the hearing, which is the critical element. How does one get that subjectivity? I think you get that subjectivity in two ways. One is a mechanism that is very, very profound, which is the mechanism of feeling. You get to be a subject because you are alive, because there is a being inside you. I think that the most important element in consciousness is the fact that there's some life within you, and that life is projecting itself in your mental space and becomes part of your experience. And then there's another thing which is critical, and this is, I think, thus far unique to my view of consciousness, and it appears in part in the sketch of it in the book, and that is that there's a way in which our brain can construct an image of our organism making images within itself. In other words, we have not only the possibility of feeling what life is in general, this fact that there's something ticking away inside you, but you also have the possibility of, quote-unquote, observing yourself making images about the rest of the world. And the way that is done is probably with something very curious, which is the separation between the system that allows us, for example, to see, which is actually done with our retinas and done with our visual cortices and all their accoutrements, and then the system that allows us to know where we are in space when we are doing the seeing, specifically when we are doing the looking. For example, right now, in order to look at you, I have my eyes in a certain position, my head is in a certain position. If I were here, in order to concentrate on you, I would have to move over. And not only that, there's a whole machinery inside my eyes in terms of the lens, in terms of the musculature that adjusts the ocular apparatus, that is sending signals about what is it that my organism is doing in order to be able to do the seeing, which is done by my retinas and by visual cortex. So we have this duality, a system that does the perception and a system that is helping the perception occurring and allowing it to be focused. We do the same thing with the ears. And of course, we have that also with the touch system. So when you combine these two things, the possibility of catching ourselves in the act of perceiving, and you have the possibility of having feeling, the two blend to create subjectivity. Now, go ask a computer to do that, or a machine. Can they? They can do one part. I think that the part about having the notion of how you're looking and in order to do the seeing, that you can accomplish computationally. The idea of implementing feelings in a thing that is not alive, that's the great barrier. It's not completely intransposable. I think there could be ways in which we could do a simulation of homeostasis. But then you get into this big problem. Is simulation the same thing as duplication? No. So we have lots of problems. It's not going to be easy to do the feeling part of subjectivity. And of course, a lot of the questions that follow, for example, questions that have to do, since you mentioned Ray Kurzweil and others that think similarly, can we download or upload, for that matter, our minds into a computer? I mean, at the moment, it's perfectly preposterous. You can't do it. Now, are we likely to do it in 30 years? Who knows? There may be some aspects of it that can, but not with the precision that would require that would be required for us to be me and you. You know, that seems to be very much out of the question. Thank you very much.
So since the brain has such an important function, one might assume that it has such redundancy, fail-safe mechanisms, you know, extra capacity, and no matter what the environment, it keeps going straight ahead or even. But change some very minor things. Give it LSD, give it alcohol, have sleep deprivation, hit it over the head with a bat, and the entire function of the brain is remarkably changed. Do you find that strange?
No, I don't find that strange at all. I think that there's clearly some redundancy, some very strong abilities, but in fact, first of all, life is incredibly vulnerable. I mean, look, I like to compare the whole process of life to the process of a jongleur. You know, you have to keep balls up in the air, and you are in a state of incredible vulnerability, and the most simple mistake can plunge the whole process and make it disappear. It's an uphill battle. Life is a very complicated thing, and it's really amazing how it's maintained. And it is because it is so vulnerable that we are prone to all sorts of diseases. The diseases are manifestations of our incredible vulnerability. And the brain is incredibly vulnerable. And it doesn't take much to move it out of kilter and create a disaster. And you can do that with drugs, of course, and you can do that by damaging the brain itself. At the same time, it's also very important, and this is one of the, I could say that there are probably two critical ideas in this book. One that has to do with the unexpected power of simple life forms to orient the design of culture, not because it creates cultures in the sense that we have today in a very complex fashion, but because they have the strategies that are fundamental, like strategies of cooperation or conflict, to orient how one can keep track of the process of life as you go into more complex creatures. So that's one of the important ideas in the book, and that's why it's called The Strange Order of Things. The other very important idea is sort of, it appears almost every chapter, is the idea that the mind is not made by brains alone, and not even made by neural systems alone. The mind is a result of a cooperation of the body and of the nervous system. And one fact that is extremely important and will tell you that I'm right about this is the following. We have had life on Earth for now nearly 4 billion years. We have had nervous systems for anywhere between 500 and 600 million years. It's quite interesting that nervous systems only appeared shortly after there were multicellular organisms. So we went through most of the history of life having single cell organisms or very few cells that did not have a nervous system and that did fine and dandy. Okay? And then we have a small part of the history of life where you have nervous systems and we have multicellular organisms. Why did we develop nervous systems? Very simple. You could not coordinate the functions in any other way. So when you have a large organism that has circulation, immune system, endocrine system, in order to try to keep all these parts together without breaking asunder, you need to have a coordination. And that's the function of the nervous system, is coordinate the stuff. Okay, and make it work so that you guess what, homeostasis or homeodynamics or whatever you want to call it. Then in the course of doing all that coordination, guess what? The brain developed these extra capacities of acquiring more knowledge, being able to manipulate the knowledge, and with a lot of smarts, being able to create new things that's the beginning of the applications that end up being the cultures that we know today. So the brains are a sort of late arrival in the history of life. Now, how were the brains put together? Well, they were put together for this coordination purpose, but they were put together by having a very close collaboration between what was in the nervous system and what was in the body, because what mattered was what was in the body. We needed to keep the body alive. That's the reason why this was selected in evolution, because it did that good job. So this idea that the nervous system is vulnerable, as you pointed out, is fine and it's to be expected. And it is not the brain and the nervous system in general is not the top of the story. We have that false impression because, of course, what we do in our culture is communicate with each other. It's perfectly obvious that I'm not communicating with you through my pancreas. I'm communicating with you because I have a brain and you have a brain and we can talk. But that doesn't mean that the brain did all that with autonomy and it was it alone doing this. And that, by the way, is one of the great problems of that we find in philosophy and in neuroscience when you try to think about how the mind was put together, is this idea that it all comes from the brain. It doesn't. The brain is an afterthought of nature.
I define myself as human because I have a consciousness and I can feel. But with the development of technology, many of us have implants and have artificial limbs. How much can I still be artificial and still be human? Can I have half a brain or a quarter of a brain and still be human with a consciousness?
That's a beautiful question. So I think, I mean, it's going to be hard to quantify how much. 20%? No, I'm joking. No, I think that you can go a long way. What you need to have is exactly those kinds of foundational... Let me backtrack. You cannot... There's no way you're going to substitute your metabolism and the foundational aspects of your physical and chemical operation. If you would substitute that, it would be a new person. So then you would lose your humanity. But as long as you keep the core of your physiological functions, even if you have, I mean, you can have a new heart that was not yours, and there are plenty of parts. For example, everything that has to do with your skeletal organization can be substituted. You can have new bones put all throughout. You cannot have a new brain. That would be very difficult because then you would lose the individuality of your personality because the individuality of your personality is tied so much to memory and to the memory of what was your past. You see, the feelings we have are unlikely to be different in their nature from the feelings that other human beings have and the feelings that other living creatures have. Why are our feelings that different from the feelings of a dog or the feelings of of another animal that you may name? They're probably not that different. What is different is the connection that those feelings have to the memories of your past and the memories of your future. Because just so that everybody knows, memory is important not just for the past, although that's the way it tends to be taken, but because of the way we are constantly making memories of what our future is going to be tomorrow or in 6 years or in 2 months. And it's that kind of memory of what we have been as individuals and what we want to be. That's the distinction of the human. Of course, language is an important distinction in relation to other animals. Our intellect is bigger, wider than the intellect of other animals. But what really gives us our distinction is the fact that we have memories of what we have been and of what we want to be. And that is, first of all, much larger in scope than any other non-human creature is likely to have, and that gives us our true individuality. So, back to your question, in order to preserve that humanity, you would need to preserve that apparatus of your history. You need to preserve the Proustian essence of you. So it's all of the remembrances of the things past, and which include, of course, many of the things that are going to come into the future, your future.
Thanks. Professor, I notice in, that's here.
Oh.
I notice in Looking for Spinoza, you write, the fact that our brain still carries the machinery to react in the way it did in a very different context long ago, and causes me to think about questions of, and this became a problem, you say, it can be a problem now. And I'm wondering, I'd like you to say a little more about the problem that that can pose for us today. Specifically, is it that our adaptive ability to have emergency reactions is so chronically turned on that it eclipses our parts of our brain with do the longer-term thinking or the social thinking or whatever it is? And then the bigger question beyond that, what do we do about it?
Yeah. So you're really pointing attention to the tremendous imperfection of what it is to be human, and what it is to be a living creature in general. And our imperfections are especially noticeable because we have such a tremendous amount of knowledge, and we have created so many situations through the development of the kind of thing that Manuel Castells studies, which is societies and their evolution with their tremendous variety. So it would be very unlikely that the machinery that is in our organisms to deal with, for example, situations of threat or situations that could cause anger and conflict or situations that would call for care and compassion, it's very unlikely that we would have systems of response that were adjusted to all of those varieties. We have some systems, and we engage them sometimes inappropriately. How does one cure that? Well, there's no cure. You tend to control it because you are intelligent and you analyze yourself and you try to control what you realize is a bad impulse. Or you depend on a culture around you that educated you in a way that was more favorable to become more adapted and compassionate than not. But you're totally in the hands of what the culture around you gave you and how intelligent and creative you are to self-control what you do, which is, of course, a very tall order. And I think that the definition of a civilized society and a civilized human being is one in which these things are in relative balance, and you're succeeding in controlling a lot of the worst impulses that you have and trying to adapt to a society. But it is, of course, a very, very difficult thing to do, and the spectacle of the failures that we have socially, politically, and so forth is exactly the spectacle of how difficult it is to do. And it gets more difficult every day. It certainly gets, if you have more information to deal with and more conflicts to deal with, it's going to be more difficult.
Now that social media is a very big part of our culture, our input on it and our intake, what have you observed, or what's your theory about the future of our evolution when it comes to stuff like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter? And are we adding another layer of consciousness beyond the way we see ourselves, seeing ourselves? Is there another thing that's being created because of the constant need to share my thoughts with strangers and whatnot?
Yeah. Well, I think we're certainly going to change the view we have of ourselves as a result of that profusion of knowledge we get all the time, day in, day out. And I have, actually, I think, very different views from Manuel on this issue, because Manuel is a super optimist on this issue. No?
Yes, no, empirically. That's a different thing.
So he's not optimist, but he thinks he knows empirically that this is not bad. And
no, it's bad or good or both at the same time as every technology. Depends what you do with it.
Okay. Well, I have a considerable fear that the profusion of information that we're getting, the speed with which we are getting it, is not going to allow us to reflect and discern as well as we might otherwise. But I know that you don't agree with this, right?
No, because you ignore, for instance, that all the young students are not so young. They do multitasking. It's their nature, as we did other things. And they don't lose their focus because they do multitasking, but they increase their capacity to recombine information because that's what they do all the time. That's why, and like many of my colleagues, I ask students in my class always to Google me, to discuss everything, to keep doing and keep doing their email. Sure, why not? Because they can do that. And they are not distracted. If they're distracted because I am boring, that's a different matter. So it's my challenge to beat internet and to beat Google, et cetera, et cetera. But I really think that in that sense, our culture is totally divided by age. The dividing line is, I'm sorry, about 35. Below 35, all this is their world, and therefore the world of the future, because the only thing we know about the future is that the people who are young today will make the future. That's the only thing we know. Although I always add to this, given our high life expectancy, we may destroy the whole thing before we disappear, my generation. But talking seriously, and I think there are different forms of living in different sets of information and communication. And the same way that the print press changed many things, and every new wave of new forms of information and communication, what happens is subverts the hierarchy of the controllers of information and communication. For instance, the teachers, for instance, the media, for instance, the politicians, and they all become very nervous because we used to have a monopoly and now we don't. But I keep thinking that even if most people in the world are stupid, of course, but the fact that they can actually intervene and thousands and thousands and thousands can debate on one issue is better than only a couple of entitled opinion leaders can debate on that issue.
Very good. Spoken like a revolutionary. Thank you, Manuel.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.